Hello and welcome to the People and Culture Podcast, a program dedicated to exploring topical and emerging issues impacting on the world of work. I'm your host, James Judge. Welcome to the inaugural People and Culture Podcast. Today, I'm very happy to be joined by an old friend of mine and CEO of Beazley Intercultural, Tamerlane Beazley. Tamerlane, thanks for coming into the studio today for a chat.
No problem, James. Great to be here.
Look, maybe you could start by telling us what it is your company does.
Sure. So we help people be effective when they work in global and diverse workplaces, which when we started the business was pretty much people who got on a plane and went overseas. Whereas the reality now is that everyone's working in a global and diverse workplace, and workplaces in Australia are incredibly diverse as well.
When we first met many years ago at the Australian National University, I think at the time you were studying East Asian languages.
Yeah.
Is that when you first got interested in intercultural communications?
No, actually. I grew up in country Victoria, a town called Bendigo, and I'd never been overseas before. And at the age of 16, I was a Rotary exchange student to Bangkok and lived with a Thai Chinese family for a year in the 80s and went to local high school and came back deeply confused about what on earth had just happened, and pretty much have spent the rest of my life trying to answer that question: what happens when people move across cultures, and how does culture shape the way we see the world? How do we engage with people who are different to us? So Asian studies at the ANU was really a step in the direction of trying to answer that question of what happens when people work in diverse environments.
And when you finished your studies, you moved to Sydney, and that's when you started your business?
I actually kept going on exchange. So I went to the US and studied international business at Penn State, and I did a thesis on cross-cultural understanding of the Thai-Lao Friendship Bridge Project, a bridge between Thailand and Laos built by the Australian government. And then I ran exchange programs at UNSW for a while, became a lecturer in cross-cultural management at UNSW, and set up my business 20 years ago. So we're celebrating 20 years this year, basis today.
You do work across different sectors of the economy. Tell us a bit about the work you do in the public sector.
So we're on a number of panels for government agencies, and we work with federal government departments that are internationally engaged, providing pre-deployment for staff working overseas, re-entry when they come back to Australia from overseas postings. We do a lot of cultural capability development. So how do you service diverse community? How do you understand the complexities of diverse communities? How do you overcome unconscious bias when you're working in a diverse community? We've also worked developing intellectual property around diversity and inclusion for some big federal government agencies. We do some work with the DFAT Diplomatic Academy, and we do work with Austrade, with trade commissioners, and we work with Department of Immigration and Border Protection as well with their offices prior to posting. So we work with lots of the international government agencies.
What about the private sector?
So in the private sector, we do a lot of training, particularly on Australian companies that are going global. So ASX top 20 listed companies, we often work with leadership teams on Asia capability, international strategy, and rolling out training programs. Particularly at the moment, what we're finding is incredibly important is, how do you understand Chinese investors? How do you work with China? Is increasingly important in the business sector. So we're doing a lot of work in that space in terms of internationalising the Australian business environment and helping people develop a global mindset, and very practical things in terms of, how do you communicate effectively when you're working across cultures? Because one thing we tend to do is, we're often very Australian in the way we use English, and Australian English can be pretty challenging for people who speak English as a second language, or people who speak English actually from the UK or the US even sometimes.
Yeah, that actually leads me to something I was thinking about prior to interviewing you today, and this is just my making something up, by the way. It's thinking about levels of cultural awareness. So I guess within a leadership group or an organisation, you might have people who range from no idea to maybe know how to not egregiously insult someone, to people who feel reasonably confident, maybe have some language proficiency to people who would be, you know, fluent, maybe understand unwritten and non-visual cues. Do you have a taxonomy or a system, or do you think in that way when you work with a client?
Yeah, so we've worked with more than 15,000 people in the last 20 years, and through that process of just repeating and delivering hundreds, if not possibly thousands now, of programs, we've actually trademarked a model, which is our APKC model, which underpins all of our programs. So a methodology, which is awareness, perspective, knowledge and capability, because so often people focus on cultural awareness, whereas what we believe and what we see works is awareness is only the first step in the cycle. So you need to be aware, but there's no other space where awareness is enough. So, for example, I'm a mountain biker. If I was biking aware, I'm not going to be very effective and it could be quite dangerous. So you actually need to have capability. So that's the C in our model. So first of all, we need awareness. We need the capacity to access and shift perspective. So we need to be able to see the world from different perspectives. We need to understand our own perspective, which is where programs like unconscious bias come in. Then we need to apply relevant knowledge. One of the common misperceptions, though, is also that you have to know everything. People who are effective across cultures acknowledge that they're never going to know everything. Good intention is really helpful. High-level communication skills are really important. Tolerance for ambiguity gets you a long way. And yes, you need knowledge, but knowledge relevant to your sector, not just any particular knowledge about a country. So we need awareness, perspective, knowledge, and capability. And so the core capabilities are around communication skills, tolerance for ambiguity. How do you develop empathy and rapport with others? How do you motivate others? How do you engage, really?
So it's more of a spectrum, I think, what you're describing.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like there's a base level, which is skills and, yeah, and awareness, but probably leads to mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of our clients we work with to deliver foundation learning programs, which builds awareness across the organization and a common language. So people are more confident understanding what cultural diversity or what diversity is. Then we tend to develop and deliver, we'll deliver very specific programs. So for leaders, for example, it might be global mindset for leaders. We'll deliver pre-deployment for people working internationally. We'll work at a strategic advisory level with the board. So we have a suite of interventions at different levels. And one thing that often happens is at the induction level, our online packages may be used. So they're brought in so that everyone in the organization has a common baseline.
You must work with some interesting clients, and I'm sure you've had some pretty challenging assignments. What's been, you know, some of the hardest work you've had to do?
People don't know what they don't know. So the challenge is we're often working with clients who don't know what they don't know to start off with. So we have to work with them to become aware of what is the breadth of understanding or capability they need. So often we'll deliver a first program and then people will have a better understanding and they'll say, oh my goodness, we need you now to work with this part of the business. So it's getting that foundation knowledge in the first instance. I think that's the challenge when you're focusing on intercultural effectiveness, is that it's not something that everyone's familiar with. So we're educating the market at the same time as engaging with it. So we find a lot of our clients we have very long-standing relationships with, and we engage with them in different ways. But for new clients, often it's a matter of, first of all, doing an e-learning program or engaging in a half-day program to get started on the journey.
Are you ever called in to do crisis support in cases where there's been a ongoing or significant cultural misunderstanding?
Often what we'll find is when businesses, for example, are acquired or engaging in joint ventures, or government agencies are becoming, it's becoming more business critical that they understand culturally diverse communities. What will often happen is people underestimate the significance of the issue and they'll say, oh, no, we just need something little, or we don't think this is really important, which is fine. But then inevitably the phone will ring 6 months later and it'll be, you know, those things that you said might happen. Well, many of them have happened. So could you come in and give us a bit more advice about what to do and how and when? So the challenge is when you engage with clients in that learning curve, because sometimes people aren't aware, and fair enough, you know, they have to go on the journey, but that's when sometimes it is a little harder because we're going in to fix or to crisis manage or to help. And the hard thing we're seeing at the moment is workplaces are changing so rapidly that often leaders are leading organisations that look radically different to the ones they grew up in and have worked in the last 10, 15 years. So if you're deploying leaders to international roles or very diverse communities, their skill set needs to shift. And how we do that when people are already very senior in a way that they are supported is quite a skill.
We had a conversation a while ago around the limited DNA pool from which senior corporate leaders come from, a study I was looking at earlier this year of CEOs and chairs of ASX 200 companies talked about how 40% more likely to be named Peter or John than a woman. And look, this sameness is not just a problem in the private sector. If you look at the secretary level at federal government, for instance, you'll see a certain sort of sameness. In your experience, how does this affect board and leadership culture?
Well, what we know is that diversity creates better decision, it contributes to better decision making. So you need cognitive diversity, you need life, people with breadth of life experience, you need different perspectives to manage risk as well as to innovate, to be agile and respond to the environment that you're in and the population you're servicing. What we're seeing is there is a lack of diversity at senior leadership levels, and there really needs to be more focus on overcoming that. So we were involved with the Diversity Council of Australia, for example, on research around the bamboo ceiling. And often there's a double jeopardy for women who are from Asian backgrounds, where you have the glass ceiling and the bamboo ceiling. So how do we actually, it's interesting because the challenge is often recognizing and promoting for capability. It's actually recognizing capability, because a lot of our interviewing, for example, is often behavioral interviewing.
Yeah.
So tell me what you're good at. Sell yourself.
Give me an example of when. That's sort of the classic behavioral.
Yeah, which is really structure. Problematic for people from many cultural backgrounds, and often women as well are quite uncomfortable blowing their own trumpet, so to speak. So how do we actually recognize whether someone's good at doing something versus whether they're good at selling themselves, because that's not necessarily the job, to sell yourself. It's to be good at something. So a lot of processes to minimize unconscious bias is taking that gut instinct out of it and looking at what true capability is, because that's what we need to harness for the future of our institutions and our organizations.
Unconscious bias, that's a really big topic, and I am going to ask you some specific questions around that. But just wanted to get you to explain this concept of the bamboo ceiling, which some of our listeners may not have heard of before.
So the glass ceiling, many people are familiar with, which is basically a certain level at which women don't tend to get promoted beyond. And the bamboo ceiling is the equivalent, but people from Asian cultural heritage, Asian cultural backgrounds. And about 10% of the Australian population have Asian cultural heritage. So the challenge in Australia is we have an incredibly multicultural community, and Australians, you can't pick an Australian by the way they're wrapped. We look like the world. But when you look at our leadership groups, often we don't reflect the reality of the Australian population. So we know that people tend to prefer and engage with people who look like them and who they're comfortable with. So it's how we expand the breadth of the pool that we're engaging with when we promote talent.
Blind auditioning in the 1950s, I think symphony orchestras were some of the first to start blind auditioning, and it had a profound impact on the makeup of symphony orchestras. More recently, you know, removing people's names from CVs and other measures in the recruitment process have been implemented to try to counter unconscious bias. There was a study by Prime Minister and Cabinet that actually suggested that blind recruiting didn't work in the Australian Public Service. It had a perverse effect. Did you see that study?
Yes, I did. And it's interesting because I think that study is an anomaly in the broader breadth of research around inclusion and diversity and unconscious bias. I think so often what we're looking for is a silver bullet or one magical thing that's going to fix the issue of lack of diversity and how do we create an inclusive workplace. And I think unconscious bias is really important, and I think recruitment and promotion based on capability, not on gut feel, is also equally important. But none of these things works in isolation. And I think one thing that's really critical is inclusion. And I think sometimes we get so fixated on diversity that we're not actually thinking about, well, how do we get an inclusive workplace when we have people from a broad range of backgrounds and life experiences coming into the workplace? And I think there's an ethical responsibility as well to not just open the doors and recruit people who are diverse without reflecting on the culture of the organization that they're coming into. So how do we ensure that, for example, we have inclusive leadership? So we have a program which is an inclusive leadership program over 12 weeks, and people do a series of online modules and reflection activities, and they're challenged to think about how inclusive are they in their practice of leadership. So simple things. How do you run a meeting? How do you ensure that you hear from all members of your team? How do you make sure you're not just asking people you're comfortable with for their perspective? How do you make sure you're not having conversations only with people like you? And we found it's quite a transformational process because people are often not challenged to reflect on their own process, but also because it's structured and there's a mentor throughout the entire program, people are supported to stretch their comfort zone and engage with difference. And it can be quite a transformational experience. So inclusion is really the piece that we need to get to. And I think sometimes there's a simplicity or naivety in the conversation because we focus on, is it just about unconscious bias? Is it just about recruitment? Well, it's actually about how do we be inclusive in our organisation so that we get the best out of our talent.
Thinking about your public sector clients, and this is probably a place where people start. They realise there's a problem, they set a quota, they implement some changes in the recruitment process. But I think, as you were saying, it's not just a pipeline process.
Absolutely. What we look at is how do we create inclusive organisations? So to do cultural effectiveness training, to do unconscious bias training, to make sure you do inclusive leadership and you have inclusive leadership practices and you access strategic advice at senior levels, all of those things work together to address some of these issues. So yes, there can be specific consultancy work around retention, but often when you start actually drilling into what's going on, it's around what's going on at an organisational culture level and how do you make sure that people are being prepared, people are being inducted appropriately. What's the way we do things around here? What's our organisational culture? How do we support people? How do we develop their capability? How do we show what appropriate behaviour looks like? And how do we develop skills? So creating those cultures where it is a learning and agile organisation.
Probably a question for another podcast, but does your work tip over into performance management?
I think, to be honest, what we find is often there's great fear around engaging with diversity and inclusion because people are scared of causing offence or that they don't know everything. And so with so much of our work, what we're doing is creating a place where people can come and learn how to be more inclusive. And often we find that there's a huge sense of relief when people come and engage with programs because they realize that, oh, no one knows everything. Some of the core things I need to be doing are actually common sense, but it's how do I apply them? So rather than yes, performance management is an issue, but that's at one extreme when things are really not working. What we find is when you work with the vast mass of an organisation to create a common language around inclusion, a common process around ensuring everyone contributes their best, you have less need for performance management. So in a way, if you come at it from a performance management angle, it's the tail wagging the dog. If you address these broader issues at induction, at training levels, at organisational cultural levels, the performance management looks after itself.
Talent, thanks again for your time and your insights.
Thanks, James.
I've been talking to Tamerlane Beasley from Beasley Intercultural. You can find them on the web at intercultural.com.au.
You've been listening to the People and Culture Podcast with me, James Judge. If you want to make a comment or have suggestions for future shows, feel free to email me, jjudge@themandarin.com.au. Thanks for listening.